The idea of robotic autonomous Indy race cars was incubated in 2018 when the state of Indiana developed a plan to spur the emerging autonomous mobility industry. The state was blessed with a ready-made testbed, the legendary Indianapolis Motor Speedway. The first autonomous Indy-style race cars made their debut in the summer of 2021 when they struggled to go 30 miles an hour. Today, the robotic-driven Indy cars are passing each other at 180 miles an hour and closing in on 200 miles per hour. According to Paul Mitchell, chairman and president of the Indy Autonomous Challenge, at present, AI drivers are not on par with human drivers, but unlike humans, AI drivers can race 24 hours a day to improve their skills. He says that each car has a driver, but it's actually a team of engineers and coders representing some of the top research universities in the world. I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer reporting from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Come along and join me for a visit with Paul Mitchell to learn the rest of the story.
Hello, I am Paul Mitchell. I'm president of Indy Autonomous Challenge here at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, talking about Indiana's history in motorsport and innovation.
Talk to us about what a trip, Autonomous Challenge. Do you have little robots driving the car?
There are robots driving the cars. They're inside a computer, so right. We don't actually have anything that looks like a robot or a humanoid type shape in the car.
But you could.
Yeah, in theory we could, but these are fully self-driving Indy-style race cars. So it's a full formula race car based on the Indy Next series, capable of a top speed of nearly 200 miles per hour.
Do these autonomous cars race each other?
They do.
Or do you put humanoids in competing vehicles?
No, we don't have any sort of man versus machine at this stage. That's not really a goal of the program.
It gets asked
all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we are still at a phase where we call them AI drivers.
Mm-hmm.
These AI drivers are still learning. Their ability to learn and improve performance is exponential. So, you know, the very first cars were built in the summer of 2021 and could barely go 30 miles an hour around a track and not go off the course. And now, a couple years later, they're going 180 miles an hour, passing one another at Las Vegas Motor Speedway, and most recently in Monza on the F1 circuit in Monza, going on a road course, which is even a different challenge from ovals. So the speed at which the AI drivers can learn and adjust and improve is really impressive, but they're still a ways away from being on par with the world's best race car drivers.
So it's competitive, the robots, right? So are there any up-and-coming rock stars?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a kind of misconception that people have. I think that autonomous race cars have no personality or are not interesting because there's no driver.
Right.
The reality is that there is a driver. It's this team of engineers, entrepreneurs, coders, these brilliant minds representing some of the top research universities in the world who code this AI driver, and the AI drivers have different skill sets. So our top teams that have been doing the best in our competitions are actually two European teams. So one is from the Polytechnic of Milano. They do have a partnership with the University of Alabama, actually. Of course, Milan and Alabama seem like natural partners,
yeah.
Of course. No, actually, they work very well together. And then Technical University of Munich in Germany.
Uh-huh.
So those two teams have really taken this to the next level. And part of the reason is that those institutions have put a lot of brain power behind the competition. They have between 7 and 10 full-time PhD students working on this. Uh-huh. This is what they do full-time.
How about we're in Indianapolis,
yeah.
Indiana. You have some legendary universities.
We do.
So do you have some statewide rock stars?
We do. So I think one of the things that's important to understand about the history of this Indy Autonomous Challenge is while we have some European universities that are very competitive, the design of the race cars, the building of the race cars, many of the components, the engine, the wiring harnesses, all of the engineering work is done right here in Indianapolis.
Mm-hmm.
And we pull from a lot of the knowledge base and skill sets that support the IndyCar series, which is really a unique mix of talent. There's not a lot of places in the world where you can build and maintain these kinds of race cars. And then from a university standpoint, we have a team from Purdue University that has been involved in the competition from the beginning. They're in the process of kind of reconstituting the team and building it up under some new leadership. And then we have another university in the state, Indiana University, has a new dean of their Luddy School of Informatics and Computer Engineering, and she comes from University of Michigan and has committed that IU wants to be in the competition. So, you know, while our universities are not yet winning the races, I think their commitment to it, their interest to it is there, and we're excited to have Indiana not only supporting the cars and the whole series, but to have universities in the mix as well.
Probably neither here nor there, but it's interesting that automotive history really has its roots in Indiana as much as Detroit.
It does. I mean, if you think about the invention of the car and that turn of the century, the early 1900s up through the 1920s, it was Indiana that was really the Silicon Valley, if you will, of the modern automobile. You had Stutz Bearcats that were being built here in Indianapolis. You had Studebakers up in South Bend. You had really most of the household name cars were being designed, engineered, and built here. And then, of course, you had these brilliant automotive minds, Allison and others, that got together and built the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, where we are today. And it was built as very much a proving ground for these early automobiles, as much as it was a place for motorsport. I don't know that motorsport was really even defined yet. And you can draw a straight line between the Indianapolis 500 and the testing of automobiles and a whole bunch of safety innovations like the rear view mirror, seat belts, braking systems, all kinds of safety systems from materials and telematics that came out of motorsports here in Indiana and found their way into the commercial realm. And that's exactly what we're trying to pick up on with this autonomous racing competitions. Our cars are capable of running at 192 miles per hour. We've got some of the most advanced technology from sensors and supercomputers and actuators that are built into these race cars. It's, you know, over $500,000 worth of hardware that's put into the car over and above what's in a regular human-driven race car.
So is there a circuit? You know, is there where you guys go around the country?
No, so we've not set it up as a traditional motorsports championship or series, and it's for a couple of reasons. Our primary objective is to test the technology and push it to the edge. And
but
so,
again, you guys are incubators, right?
Yeah.
So but there's evolution.
Yeah, there could be in the future. But, you know, one, when you're doing a lot of testing of technology, you need to be able to make adjustments to the cars. And so we take pauses between our events. So we just ran in Monza in June, and it was a very successful competition.
And how many vehicles?
We had six teams there.
Uh-huh.
We have nine vehicles total. Six teams went to that competition
like
in Monza.
And that's like a Le Mans course?
It's a road course. It's an F1. It's the oldest road course in the world, actually.
Wow.
And the oldest in Europe, for that matter, and the longest running F1 circuit. So after that racing competition, we are in the process of overhauling a lot of the hardware on the car to put in new LiDAR, new radar, new drive-by-wire systems. Why are we doing that? Because we want to continue to make sure that the technology on the car is at the absolute bleeding edge, and our sponsors are providing this technology so we can test it for them, right, for industry. The other issue we have with trying to run it as a traditional motorsport series is our teams are PhD students from top research universities. This is their focus, but it's a research project. They're not a racing team that can go around from location to location. They still have to be taking classes,
right,
or teaching classes, and going back to their campuses.
But on a literal race day, event day.
Oh, it's just like any other racing event.
They're here. They're in the pit.
They're a professional racing team. Uh-huh. They've got all their gear. They're in the pits. They're tuned in completely. The one part that's really interesting is our competition, once the car leaves the pits, when it's a race, the team can have zero interaction with the car. It has to run fully autonomous.
Oh, wow.
It has to make all of its decisions on its own.
So they're spectators.
Speed adjust. So they have to sit back and watch what happens and hope that it runs well.
Right.
In practices, they can have some limited interactions. They can make adjustments. But when it's race time, you know, we have a very strict rule that it's hands off at most once in a while they can tell race control to send a increased speed command, or they can say red button, like we're seeing something we don't like on our data, stop the car.
So it just follows that even though it's robotics, by default there's a personality to the cars and a competitive fan base that's going to evolve, right?
Yeah, there's definitely different levels of risk and different race lines that the different AI drivers that these teams are coding take. Mm-hmm. There's different risk tolerances about how aggressive they'll pass. And we've seen it play out in pretty spectacular fashion. I mean, there's been some final races we've had at Las Vegas Motor Speedway during CES. The whole state of Indiana goes out to CES to watch this and celebrate our innovation. You know, there's been overtakes at the very end where one team is, you know, taking a more aggressive line and the other team, you know, has to back off because their AI driver really just hasn't been pushed to that level. So there's a lot of decisions that teams have to make before a race or going into a new competition. You know, what are they going to set the limit at, right? Is the limit unlimited? Are they going to go as fast as the car goes until it wrecks? Or are they going to say, no, we want to set it at this threshold?
Yeah.
And you see that play out.
As it evolves, it just seems inevitable they're going to take on almost humanoid characteristics of that competitiveness, right?
Yeah, I think that there's a couple of things holding back the ability of autonomous race cars to be at the level that people are familiar with when they watch something like a IndyCar event or NASCAR or Formula One. And those are all things we're working on here in this ecosystem in Indiana. So one is just getting the hardware to function with incredibly low latency. So you need all your sensors, your LiDAR, your radar, your optical, which is basically cameras, to be flowing that data to the central computer extremely efficiently.
So because it's all about speed.
All about speed, low latency, efficient processing. And then the actuators that turn the wheel, do the braking, they have to be able to be sustained at very high speeds and, you know, lots of G-force. And we're using hardware that is designed primarily for commercial vehicles traveling, you know, at 30, 40, 50 miles an hour, maybe 100 miles an hour at most on the highway. And so, you know, that's where we're still working to get the cars at a place where the AI driver can really have full control. And then in parallel, the universities are constantly running these AI drivers through models. So the difference between a human driver and an AI driver is that a human driver, even if they have unlimited resources, they're still only going to have a limited amount of track time. They have to sleep, they have to eat, they have to travel, they have to do appearances. You can have an AI driver in a simulator 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, improving their understanding of a track and improving their understanding of different, you know, competitive racing situations. So that kind of computer learning, machine learning that's taking place is happening in the labs of these universities, so that each time they come to a competition, it's not as if their driver's not been on the track, they've just been on a virtual track.
Yeah.
And so if you can get that virtual environment and the physical environment to really be a, we call it a digital twin of one another, but really, you know, a replication, then that's what will unlock the full potential of AI in the context of autonomous mobility. And we want to be the center of that action here in Indiana because we're the racing capital of the world, but we want to be, you know, the technology innovation capital of motorsports as well.
Interesting. I think I mentioned I've covered Bristol Motor Speedway.
Yeah.
And they call it the gladiator competition. The fans are just going viral cheering their different cars, right? But you can't see the driver at Bristol. You see the car in a helmet in a shade. The difference from viewed, it might as well be robotics. And yet the fans are just going crazy over their car or their driver.
Their driver.
So I'm taking extrapolating going forward.
I think it's
palpable where you guys are going.
I think that there is something very special about human race car drivers. You know, seeing a human operate at that level, the almost superpowers, and they really are, their reaction time, their endurance, their ability to handle G-forces and make decisions. It's like a fighter pilot. And the analogy I like to make is that you know, think about the fighter pilots that were out there in World War I, World War II, doing dogfights, and how much they relied, you know, exclusively on the humans' perception. You know, if the plane was behind them, they had to physically turn around to see it. They had to wait until they could shoot until the plane was lined up perfectly. And think about the fighter pilots today flying in an F-35, which is essentially an autonomous airplane that the human is in there as kind of the captain running all these different systems. And think about the capabilities of those jets today versus the ones in the past. I think you can see on race cars, particularly in the top series like Formula One and IndyCar, and NASCAR as well, the level of technology is advancing on the car. And eventually, if you give those human drivers the kind of capabilities that these top fighter pilots have, where they can have 360-degree perception, where they can brake in a way that is separating the front and back brakes from one another, and all these kinds of things that you can do in an autonomous vehicle, I think it'll lead to more competitive racing at higher speeds. And frankly, it will improve safety, because I don't think anybody wants these race car drivers to get hurt. That's obviously, you know, terrible for them, terrible for the industry. And so can you improve safety and allow race car drivers to operate at even higher speeds? To do that, we need this technology that we're working on to blend with the human driver. And I frankly think that will be the most exciting for fans. I think fans will be more interested in watching human drivers empowered by cars that could be driving themselves. And the humans taking it to the next limit, the next level, more so than just watching the robot cars themselves.
Yeah, interesting. So when did it first start? When is for actually racing?
The concept started in 2018, and the state of Indiana was looking for ways to break out and have a role in this emerging autonomous mobility industry.
Across
the board. Other states, you know, to the north, Michigan was taking a strategy of building test beds, like M-City at the University of Michigan, which is a wonderful facility. And Indiana said, well, you know, rather than build a new test bed, we already have the world's most famous test bed. It's the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Can we bring back that concept of using that asset to advance autonomous mobility? And our niche is high-speed autonomous mobility. So you can go to other test tracks and see autonomous cars driving 30, 40 miles an hour working on what I would call the robo-taxi use case, which we're seeing play out in real time now in places like San Francisco and elsewhere. But to work on high-speed automation where you've got cars going 150 miles an hour, if we can get that right and you can transition that to highways and now you've got trucking and cars that can travel at much higher speeds than humans are capable of driving and do so safely, we're going to change the world from the standpoint of mobility and commerce and reducing traffic deaths. That's the problem that Indiana saw and wanted to work on. And so this has really been a public-private partnership where the state of Indiana is investing, philanthropy in the state is investing, industry and companies, partners with the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and IndyCar. And we did so in a way that we invited the whole world to participate, and the whole world was interested. And so here we are. It's been a tough journey because we had COVID happen in the middle of it. So getting teams over from Europe and other parts of the world was no easy task. But, you know, Hoosiers banded together. We had Purdue University helping with visas, getting students over from Europe that otherwise couldn't come into the country. And so this has really been a collective effort here in Indiana. And now we're at a point where it's an asset that showcases our capabilities, our innovation, and frankly, the sort of entrepreneurial spirit that the state was willing to take this kind of risk. I mean, this could have been a complete and utter failure, and yet the state wanted to say, if this can be done, it should be done here.
Paul, this has been great. Thank you so much. Anything closest to your heart?
We're excited for next year. 2024 is going to be a really banner year for Indy Autonomous Challenge. We're improving the cars. We're going to be talking about some races that we haven't announced yet. I can tell you for sure we're going to be at CES in January, and then we're also going to be back at Monza in Italy in the summer. But we've got another big race that we haven't started talking about yet that we're going to be announcing soon here in the United States that we're incredibly excited about. So I think for people that are not familiar with what we're doing, 2024 is a great year to come and watch, because the level of competition is going to start to be more on par with what motorsports fans are used to seeing on racetracks.
I love it. Paul, to learn more about your world, where would you direct
Easiest place to go is IndyAutonomousChallenge.com, but also check out the Indiana Economic Development Corporation's website, the IEDC. We work hand in glove with them, and they can talk to you. You can learn a lot more about the kind of innovation ecosystem that we're a part of here in the state of Indiana there.
Love it. We've been speaking with Paul Mitchell, chairman and president of the Indy Autonomous Challenge. And we're at the racetrack in Indianapolis, right?
What a great spot, right?
I know. Front row center, literally.
Yeah.
All right. And I'm your host, Tom Wilmer.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, iTunes, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
This is Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting here with Tom Wilmer. Please support your local NPR station. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. If I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.